Thanks, Shane. Thank you very much.
It's the Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Insult us.
Gormagut, Phoebe, good afternoon on this Tuesday afternoon. How are you? 51551 ray@rte.ie. For a lot of us, it's a short week. Just remind you of that, because sometimes Tuesdays can be tough. You get through Monday, because you have to, and then Tuesday comes along and you go, a Tuesday in March, and it's dark and it's wet again out there. But you're Friday off. Yay! St. Patrick's Day on Friday, which is great. I just spotted this. The CEO of Unpost, Dave McRedmond, has tweeted, and there's a picture of a postbox painted gold, and written on the postbox is Richie Bainham, best visual effects, Avatar The Way of Water. And alongside the photograph, Dave McRedmond tweets, "Ah, lads, if you win an Oscar, apparently you also get a gold postbox. Get that into your visual effects, Richie Bainham." Now, we don't know where it is. We don't know how it got there. We don't know if Unpost did it themselves, or was it Ballyferma College or further education, because that's where Richie studied. And I saw there was a letter into the Irish Times today. With the win by Richard Bainham of a second Oscar, Ballyferma College of Further Education graduates have achieved 10 Oscar nominations and 2 Oscars. Well done to Ballyferma College. And that's from Joanna Tuffy, who's a Labour councillor out there in Lucan. So Tom Moore and Paul Young, they work with Cartoon Saloon, and they've got 5 nominations over the years. Nora Toomey, they all attended Ballyfermot. A great college out there that is doing brilliant work, particularly in the area of animation and that sort of thing. And well done to everybody there. And well done again to Richie. We didn't give him a mention yesterday. And we've got to mention as well our friend Charlie McAsee, him, the author of The Boy, the Mole, the Fox and the Horse. And then he produced, directed the animation, half-hour animation, which went out over Christmas and is now available on Apple Plus, if you didn't see it. It is a beautiful thing. And obviously, the Academy agree, because Charlie won an Oscar for Best Short Animation. And it's well worth a watch. The Boy, the Mole, the Fox and the Horse. And he's been on the show a lot. We love him here. He's just such a lovely human being. And he got up in front of all the suited and booted stars of the world, stars of world cinema. And he told us this story as well, that he said he was down in the village and he'd got nominated for the Oscars. And he said to a woman he knows, "You know, I'm going to the Oscars and I need some help with my clothes." And she said, "Yes, you will." See, I think that's very funny, but nobody laughed last night. And you could see poor Charlie sort of was, you know, he had to regain his confidence, and he went on and told a story about his dog in a hotel. Anyway, congratulations to him. Well done. And while we're still on Oscar talk, is this a joke? Is it April 1st? No, it's not. Seemingly, there's a Banshees of Inisherin computer game which has been launched tomorrow. It puts you in the cracked leather shoes of an ageing musician on a labyrinthine quest for a quiet pint. On your way to the pub through the rocky roads, you must elude your former best friend, dodge the local gobshite and an Orny Garda, avoid the unavoidable neighbour and collect 5 bloody fingers. Is that makey-uppy? Seemingly it's not. It's the work of Cogs and Marvels, and their creative director is John Hosier Byrne, and you'll recognise that name because he is brother of Hosier. So a talented family there. I don't play computer games, but I'd be interested in just having a go at that one. The Banshees of Inisherin, the computer game. Michael Caine is 90 today. Michael Caine is 90 today. We only talked about him last week because I spotted him in The Eagle Has Landed from 1976, where he played the part of a German officer. He's been doing what he does for 7 decades or thereabouts. He's been in 160 films. 160. He's got 2 Oscars, statuettes, Academy Awards, whatever you want to call them, for Best Supporting Actor for his roles as Elliot in Hannah and Her Sisters, 1986, and Dr. Wilbur Larch in The Cider House Rules, 1999. He started his career on the big screen in Zulu, 1964. That's the year I was born. The Italian Job, brilliant movie. Battle of Britain, they were in 1969. Get Carter, 1971. The Eagle Has Landed, 1976. The Bridge Too Far, 1977. This is him from The Italian Job. Michael Caine, happy birthday to you.
5, 4, 3, 2, One, go.
Oh!
You're only supposed to blow the bloody doors off.
Michael Caine. And he was a regular on with Michael Parkinson.
It's wonderful, actually, sitting here and listening to your talk, because, it, I mean, yours is the most impersonated voice in the business, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, everyone. Everybody does. I can do it.
Can you do it?
Yeah, yeah. Hello, my name is Michael Caine. I'm finished. Not many people know that.
Very good impersonation of Michael Caine. Michael Caine does a very good impersonation of himself. We just discovered that post box, the gold one, in honour of Richard Bainham, it's outside Ballyferma College, and on post put it up overnight. Lefanu Road, busy road in Ballyferma, if you want to go out and get your picture taken alongside it. We're fascinated at home by the number of streams that songs and artists get on Spotify. John Fogerty, him of Creedence Clearwater Revival, has entered into the Billions Club. The Billions Club, yes. These are people who've got more than 1 billion streams on Spotify. Get your head around that. 1 billion times. People have decided to play your song 1 billion times. I find it hard to get my head around that. It's a low-key enough tune, isn't it? It's a low-key enough. The aforementioned Hozier, he's in the Billions Club on Spotify with this.
Take me to church, I worship like a dog at the shrine of your life. I'll tell you my sins and you can sharpen your knife. Offer me that deathless death, the good God, let me give you my life. Take
That's actually to church, touching on 2 billion streams. 2 billion people have streamed that. Other ones you'd know, well, from up north, Snow Patrol.
If I lay here, if I just lay here, would you lie away?
You know, if you're having a bad day, right, you woke up one morning, you're having a bad day, and you just go, yeah, over 1 billion people have streamed something that I created. That'd sort of perk you up, wouldn't it? Be out of the bed after that. Snow Patrol. Over 1 billion streams, as does.
Another one bites the dust. Another one bites the dust. And another one gone. And another one gone. Another one bites the dust. Hey, hey, we're gonna get you too. Another one bites the dust.
There you go. Queen, another one bites the dust. So congratulations to John Fogerty and all the other members of the Billions Club. St. Patrick's Day, as I say, is looming this Friday, and we are looking to hear about all the smaller parades with heart that are happening around the country. We'd love to hear from anyone out there who might be in the middle of finessing their floats or in the midst of some majorette training. I remember there used to be up in Leitrim somewhere, they used to have an oddball parade every year. Sometimes it was the smallest. Then one year they did it backwards. Another year they did it around a pool table. Maybe I'm dreaming this. I think that actually happened. So if there's any oddball celebrations for St. Patrick's Day, not the big city ones, we know they exist and people go to them and that's fine. But we'd like to hear about the more oddball things that are happening this Friday around the country or even around the world. Yes, around the world if you're listening, because we know people tune in. Sometimes this is part of their morning routine if they're in the States. Anyway, anything that's happening that you think we should know about on St. Patrick's Day, ray@rte.ie, ray@rte.ie. And we'll be doing a roundup on Thursday, talking to all the people about what's happening in their locality. Now, this is an unusual one, and I'm going to throw it out there because I don't know the answer. And it came in from a listener. I know people who suffer the same problem, and I don't know how common it is, but you might be able to help. Ray, help. Well, there you go. That got my attention. I'm writing to you watching my fingers type with stubby, torn nails. Desperate for a bit of advice on how I can stop biting them as a 40-year-old woman. I could just exercise some self-control, but it's never worked. I take all my inner anxieties out on my nails, and it's so built into my self-conscious that I find myself gnawing away at what's left of them out of pure instinct. I've tried it all over the years, the foul-tasting varnish, fake nails, treating myself to expensive manicures to try and deter myself, but I always find myself in the same quandary. I know it's a disgusting habit. My 10-year-old daughter even tries to stop me when I do it, but it's the same every time. Sometimes, when there are no nails left, I've resorted to picking at the frayed skin around them. It's gross, and I know that. I'm getting married in August, and I need to tackle this now so I can give myself a fighting chance of having a halfway decent finger for him to slip a wedding ring on. And I would love for the nail at the end of it to be A, my own, and B, not chewed to bits. I've seen people using this new builder in a bottle polish, BIAB, but I'm so embarrassed about the state of my hands that I would like to stop altogether before I present myself to a manicurist to try and transform them for the gnarled claws they are into. Well, just a normal nail will do. If your lovely listeners have any suggestions for me, some sage advice on how they did it, I'm willing to try anything at this point. So it's a common enough thing, I know there are people listening who've managed to overcome it. They've managed to cease and desist chewing at their nails. I knew somebody years ago who, and this is quite disgusting, but they made themselves bleed. They bit their nails so much. And maybe it starts about nerves and then becomes habit. I don't know the psychology of it. But if you've been through it and you're out the other side and now you have nails that you can bring to a manicurist and you've nails that you don't feel embarrassed about presenting to a man to put a ring on your finger, please let us know how you did it. ray@rte.ie 51551. Love Michael Caine. My favourite film of his is Little Voice with Brenda Blethyn. We interviewed her on the telly. She's a lovely woman. Yeah, there was Jane Horrocks, Ewan McGregor and Jim Broadbent in that as well. A star-studded British cast. Ray, not 2 billion people necessarily. It could be 8 million people streaming many times. I know that, Martin, but still, it was played. It was played 2 billion times. And I know there are repeat offenders or repeat customers or whatever you like. But still, it doesn't. You can't argue with the facts that somebody somewhere at some stage has decided 2 billion times, you know, people all over the planet have decided 2 billion times to listen to your song. I just can't get my head around that. Anyway, 51551 ray@rte.ie. Good afternoon. Thank you. Kevin Westport, who is our resident pop music statistician, has been on to say Blinding Lights by The Weeknd, two E's, not three, is the most streamed song of all time on Spotify with over 3.4 billion streams. Wow. And did you know, Kevin, that he has seven? The Weeknd has 7 songs that have been streamed over a billion times. Very popular. And he has over 100 million monthly listeners. Ray, for your nail biter, tell her to soak her fingertips in mulled vinegar every night. There are no side effects and the smell will stop her from biting her nails. Yeah, then you have to go around smelling of vinegar all the time. If it works, we'll suggest that. If they're listening, there you go, malt vinegar. Is there anything that vinegar isn't a solution to? Advice for the fingernail biting. Been doing it since I was 3 or 4. I'm 25 now. However, there was a stint of 2 years when I was 21, 23, where any time I was at home or doing nothing, I'd wear gloves. You can't bite them when they're covered. I found I mainly did it when doing nothing, i.e. at home when all my anxious thoughts were most prevalent. I'll bite them again, but that's due to my mental state being worse now, but thought maybe this could help. It sounds like something, and maybe this is overly simplifying it, but we were talking to Padraig O'Moran last week about mindfulness and concentrating on your breathing. And if there is a time where you tend to bite your nails, maybe you could concentrate your breathing and do a bit of 7-11 breathing. Inhale for 7, exhale for 11. Maybe that might work. I don't know. Now, we're looking for 2 people to come on after 4 o'clock and take part in our Who Done It quiz. Yeah, 2 quizzers, 3 Who Done It questions on music, sport, TV, books, politics, film and comedians. Indeed, anything that involves human endeavour. Like all Who Done It, there will be clues. If you answer without a clue, you get 2. If you answer with a clue, it's easier. You get 1 for a correct answer. And there's a prize. It's a luxurious break for 2 to Photo Island Resort in Cork. Nestled at the heart of a peaceful island surrounded by gorgeous scenery and just 8 miles from the bustling city of Cork, pack your bags and escape to your own private island with Photo Island Resort. We have a two-night stay, as I said, for 2 adults with breakfast each morning and dinner on one of the evenings in the Amber Lounge, to be warned. Loads of things to do down there. There was a swimming pool, world-class spa, the exclusive Cove restaurant. There's a golf course. And then in its environs, you have Photo Wildlife Park, Photo House and Gardens. You can pop into Cork to the English Market, do a bit of shopping. You can go the other direction, out to Ballymaloe or Ballycotton. PhotoIsland.ie. PhotoIsland.ie. Okay, here is Tuesday's qualifying question. Who's announced a visit to Ireland? Joe Biden or Joe Pesci? Who has announced a visit to Ireland? Joe Biden or Joe Pesci? 0818 715 925. That's 0818 715 925.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Email ray@rte.ie. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Back June last year, we sat down with a young filmmaker from Bray who travelled to Ukraine and was documenting the lives of those in the midst of war. And we decided we'd catch up with him again. Finn Boylan joins us in studio again. You're from Bray. Hosier's from Bray as well?
Yeah, actually, I went to school with Hosier.
Oh, did you?
He was the water boy for the rugby team in St. Gerard's. And Jack Conn was on the team also. Him number 8, I was number 4. So that's a long time ago. And we're all... Yeah, doing well, it seems.
Jack Conan, that was great. Did he score a try?
He scored a try on the weekend.
That was an amazing try.
Yeah.
What a brilliant win over Scotland. So now we're up there for the Grand Slam against England at the Aviva this Saturday, 5 o'clock.
Yeah, he's in his own war.
Oh, he's in his own war. Yeah. So the anniversary's come and gone. First of all, remind us about you. You're a documentary maker. What brought you to Ukraine?
I studied history, politics, and I've always been fascinated by that, and I've been deeply fascinated by geopolitics. I mean, like I said to you on your show before, every nation state that exists in the world is a result or an outcome of conflict, and we're chronically aware of that here in Ireland. So I studied film. I was living in Germany and travelled to many hotspots before, including Mali, West Bank, Nagorno-Karabakh, but nothing on the scale of this. And when... I've been following this war since 2014. It coincided, the revolution in Maidan coincided with my graduation, 2014, so 9 years ago now. And that was kind of like what sparked my interest in this. And I knew then that this conflict already had the potential to upset the long peace that we've enjoyed in Europe for the last 70 years. And I knew then that, you know, that peace is incredibly fragile. And seeing what happened now, I was in a perfect position to document it. I had the camera skills, I had the knowledge, I'd been around. And so, yeah, I went for it. And I arrived actually on Sunday now, just gone, is the 1 year anniversary of when I arrived in Ukraine.
So only a couple of weeks after it started?
3 weeks in I arrived, 12th of March. And I hit the ground running. Met an Irish mechanic from Wicklow also. He was a mechanic on a bunch of Irish ambulances that were sent by the HSE out there. Filmed with them, the Irish ambulances evacuating some kids from Kyiv. And then when those ambulances were sent on to forward locations, I decided to head for Kyiv, and I followed the Irish mechanic into the Lion's Den at the end of March. So I was in Kyiv for the last week for the Battle of Kyiv. We came in via the only route that was open, the southwest. And yes, Kyiv was surrounded on three sides at the time. The Russians had stalled basically at the gates, but I didn't know that going in. And I'll never forget getting off the platform, a bit of laughing and joking with Graham, who's the Irish mechanic. He was shadowing two foreign fighters who were going to join up. They were all going to join together. And we were all, enjoying ourselves on the train in. And when we departed the train at 6 a.m, the ground was shaking with the amount of shelling going on. And coming up the stairs to the checkpoint, police checking my passport and flicking through the pages, looking for the entry stamp. A massive explosion rang out only about a kilometre away. A missile had hit the city. I ducked down. I looked at the window that was overlooking the train. I just got off down the platform. There was tape across the window. And that's the only thing that stopped it from shattering on me. And I remember ducking down with the lads. And I looked up and the policeman was not even flinching. He was just keep scrolling through my passport like another mundane day at work. And that's how quickly you can become desensitized to this. And it gave me two things. It made me realize, I'm not in any immediate danger right now, but it also made me realize that despite having been to hot zones in Mali or Nagorno-Karabakh or West Bank, like I had never experienced real war before. And I got it on my camera for the next week. I was out in the front in Irpin, in Bucha for the liberation, and then down in Mykolaiv for the start of the Ukrainian counter-offensive. And then went was also this past Christmas, from October to Christmas, filming in the meat grinder that is Bakhmut in Donbass. So in total, I've spent nearly five months in country. And my.
So why, just before we carry on, why do you do it? And I know you've outlined you have an interest in geopolitics. You're a documentary maker, but you were putting yourself in danger because you were documenting it at very close quarters. And I've seen some of your footage, and there are explosions happening. So much so that the camera, you know, the camera falls or is shaking or whatever.
Yeah, I came close twice, Ray. At the start of the Ukrainian counteroffensive in May, I was directly targeted for shelling and I barely escaped with my life.
You weren't personally targeted, right?
We arrived in a recently liberated village. It was only liberated 10 days before. It was a command post for the Russian army. And I arrived there with the only way to get out to that recently liberated area was with a press officer. We drove out in my vehicle, a press vehicle, press markings all over it. The town is, village is abandoned. Went into the school, which was the headquarters, and was filming in the school no more than 5 minutes when the first shell came in. We didn't think anything of it immediately. Like, we were more than 10 kilometres behind the front line at that point. So we just thought it was a stray shell. We took cover in a hallway, in a stairwell of a hallway, the most foundationally secure part of the building. And waited 2 minutes, but then the next one came in closer and they were adjusting their fire and each one was getting closer and closer. Wow. And closer. So it was a very clear day. My theory is there was a drone up in the air and tracked our movement into the village, and as soon as we disembarked our vehicles and went in, they started lobbing shells at us.
Yeah, and you went back for more. So the why question is important.
The why, what motivates me, Ray, is I have so much on my hard drive, so much stories that need to be told. And if I don't finish this, no one's going to tell those stories and they're going to remain on my hard drive. Nobody will see them. As so many people trusted me with their pain, their trauma and their story, whether it be the Irish ones that I have, but particularly the Ukrainian ones, you know. And if I don't finish this, you know, I'll have that weight on my shoulder for the rest of my life, and know that I'll never be able to give a platform for those people to share that experience, because and I just want to be a window for Irish audiences into a conflict that we're so far removed from geographically, but we're far closer to it than many would think. I mean, I've got several characters, Irish characters in my film, two ex-Irish soldiers, an ex-Irish fireman, and a mechanic, like I mentioned in the beginning, yeah. And also a Ukrainian soldier whose wife and kids are refugees in a hotel in Leitrim. So all of these stories, you know, bring such a global context of such a huge information, bombardment of information. It focuses down.
Yeah, when you listen to the news reports,
yeah,
how do you feel? Like, they're doing a particular job. They're telling stories. The way you tell stories is different.
Yeah, I mean, every news station has its own narrative. Even RTE would have its own narrative, of course. Everybody does. Well, I mean, what frustrates me a lot, actually, now that you mention it, is, I don't know if your listeners would be aware of what's happening in Bakhmut for the last 6 months. It is the cauldron, essentially. It is the meat grinder. It is all over the news on Western media. And they constantly, thing that gets parroted is, it's not a strategic town. It will be a Pyrrhic victory for the Russians if they win it. That's just simply not true. If they win that town, they are a stone's throw away from the last two remaining cities of any meaningful significance and size in the Donbass, Kramatorsk and Slovyansk. And if they take those, they've won the Donbass. And why is that important? Two reasons. One, it's the high ground in all of the Donbass region. The Ukraine is called the Ukrainian steppe. It's flat as a pancake, but that's the highest ground in all of Ukraine. Two, it's the industrial heartland. There's 1.5 trillion euros worth of gas, oil, steel, coal, rare earth minerals, all the essential ingredients for perpetuating war, mechanized warfare long term. If Russia take this, Ukraine's capabilities to essentially conduct long-term warfare are scuppered, basically, and they will continue to rely on the West to fight this war. So when people say, when the Western media says Bakhmut is not strategically important, it's a Pyrrhic victory, I just simply don't agree with it, like, at all. You have to be there, look at the ground, look at the topography, and you can clearly see. Look, every single town is a salt mine, a coal mine, a steel factory. You know, we're not talking about wheat fields out in the west of Ukraine, and that was a big crisis early on in the war, the lack of wheat going out through the port of Odessa. That has an impact on the wider world, of course, yes, but not in Ukraine. But for the Ukrainians to fight long-term mechanized warfare, they need those minerals.
And you were saying that in speaking to Ukrainians, they accept that this is a generational thing, that it's not going to be over in a hurry.
Absolutely not. I mean, this war started 9 years ago already. So it's already been going on nearly a decade. How long? Define a generation for me. Yeah. The generation is 20 years. We're halfway there already. So for the Ukrainian soldiers, I mean, most of them are guys like They get a lot of them, unfortunately, they get 3 days of training and they're thrown into the meat grinder. It's the same story for the Ukrainians as it is for the Russians, but they're far highly more motivated to do it because they see it. If I don't do it, my kids will have to do it. And that's why they're fighting. They're fighting for the existence of their nation, of their identity. And you know, I've heard it so many times. One of the best quotes I heard from a Ukrainian soldier is like, yeah, they probably thought they could beat us. They look at us like dogs, but every dog is a lion in his own home. And that really summed up the spirit of the Ukrainians. And they are losing a horrific amount of men. I mean, I stood in the field hospital in Bakhmut for one afternoon, and I must have seen about 100 guys come in. Don't know how many were dead because they were all in stretchers, some covered up, some not, but bodies just left around. The morgues were overflowing in that hospital that day. And that's just one afternoon, you know, in one city, on one area of a front that's over 1,500 kilometers long. It's insane. It's totally insane. Hmm. So, I mean, if I get the chance to document this history, I mean, I will have played my part. If I can be a window for the Irish audiences to understand this conflict through the Irish characters that I've been following, one in particular that, you know, that's basically the purpose of the film, is to showcase the Irish humanitarian spirit in this conflict.
So you have the mechanic, you have two ex-soldiers and an ex-firefighter.
Exactly.
And you were following them around.
All of them at different points in the conflict, but specifically out in Donbass, I was following the two ex-Irish soldiers and the firefighter, ex-firefighter. I'll go through them by names. One I can't name right now because he was in Kyiv on the very day of the invasion, and he held an opinion, very interesting at the time, that Ukraine should surrender immediately. After he saw the spirit of the Ukrainian resolve, he joined the Foreign Legion and is now conducting drone operations out in the front line. Doesn't want to be named right now, is in my film, but when he's done and dusted and comes back, he's given me the permission to release his name. The second would be Dayton Brennan. Now, Dayton, he's incredibly showcases that nothing is really stronger than the heart of an Irish volunteer. He was working for a group called the Mozart Group, bunch of ex-American military. He's 20 years in the Irish Defence Forces. He's an advanced paramedic. He was head of the evac team that was pulling civilians out of the frontline areas, like literally within touching distance of Wagner positions, 400 metres under small arms fire. And
what's a Wagner position?
Wagner is the private military contracting group, the mercenaries on the Russian side, the Wagner group.
Right.
And he was working for the Mozart group, and it was kind of set up as a tit for tat against each other. Mozart is a German composer.
Wagner is
a German composer. But these two organizations stand in stark contrast in opposition to what they actually do. Wagner is a private mercenary company, purported to have committed horrific war crimes, while Mozart is a crew of 50 guys, and the head of the evac team is a guy from me, the ex-Irish soldier. And they're only 50 guys. They train the Ukrainian military and they do civilian evacuations. So Dayton actually had a hit on his head. This is a really interesting story, but that's part of the film. Dayton was a wanted individual on the Donbass front. The Wagner group wanted him dead. So he had a hit on his head and still was going out to frontline positions, pulling.
And would they be that close that they'd know who was involved?
Dayton would tell me a story that when the Wagner group would come into a village. So this is a point. Many of the people don't want to leave, and they only want to leave when it gets too real.
Of course.
You know, nobody wants to leave their home.
No.
And you're literally pulling them out while the shells are coming in. And I have footage of Dayton holding bags of everything this poor old woman can carry. He's carrying them for her, and a shell lands, and he takes shrapnel into his body armor. And that's the level of within touching distance of how far our Irish characters and the humanitarian spirit touches the front. But some of the people would call asking for an evac, and there was even a story that Dayton told me that Wagner were already in the town, Russian mercenaries were already in the town, and it was already gone, and he got a phone call from one of the people to come and evacuate him. So when he arrived to the town, the Ukrainian military were retreating, pulling out, and they were like, no, don't go in there, the Wagner group have taken it, but we've got an evac coming. So Dayton does, and then stories came out later that several people in that village were set on fire by the Wagner group, like burned. Well, a man in his wheelchair were burned, so burned alive. So Dayton is not too sure whether after that happened, he was instructed by the mercenaries to make the phone call so Mozart and Dayton would come in and evacuate, because they would always go. Every time they got a call, they would go evacuate them. So this really showcases the strength of the Irish humanitarian spirit and the resolve. And they're the stories I want to tell, because if nobody's doing it.
And you also talk to Ukrainian soldiers. And as you mentioned earlier on, that one of them had a family. I don't know if the family's still there, in a hotel in Leitrim.
Yeah.
So you were in Ukraine, came back with stuff from him,
yep,
and brought them up to Leitrim. What sort of stuff?
That was a very special moment for me. That was after the end of my first round in Ukraine, and came back in the summer, spoke to you actually, yeah, in June, and then I headed up to Leitrim. Now I'd been given some ammo casings for his son, his 13-year-old boy, and a few little, you know, patches of his unit that would be on the shoulder of his uniform to give to the kids. And when I arrived at in Leitrim, it's Ballinamore in County Leitrim. Interviewed the wife, interviewed
all on camera,
yeah, and yeah. I gave it to them on camera, and I showed the wife and kids footage of their dad, you know, on the front doing his job, being a hero, and they all kind of started crying and breaking down, and it was a very special moment for me, and it's a great moment in the film. And then they gave me letters and drawings from the kids to bring back to Vasil, is his name, Sergeant Vasil, to bring back to him and deliver to him when I got back to Ukraine, which I did. It was the first thing I did when I got back. And very strong, powerful man, seen it all. And he broke down when I gave it to him. And that was a very special moment for me and a very special moment in the film.
It's unimaginable what those families are feeling, so far away from their homeland, firstly, and secondly, having their loved ones fighting a war.
Absolutely.
I mean, not knowing if they're going to survive it.
And actually, just as you mentioned last week, Sergeant Vasil was wounded. A thermobaric bomb went off in his near his trench, and he already had concussion from the Battle of Kiev, like bad concussion. And yeah, he's in hospital now in Dnipro with a bleed on his brain. So, you know, going back, I'd love to see him, and hopefully he's doing better.
So you do plan to go back?
Yeah, absolutely. There are the Irish fireman, Dandrew Last is his name. Great story also. Father-in-law, Ukrainian wife, went to Ukraine to evacuate the father. Was eventually successful in doing it. Very complicated mission. The father-in-law was in hospital in the separatist region. So to get him out of on the Russian side was next to impossible. But through his connections, managed and time in country in Luhansk, because he married the wife there in the Luhansk People's Republic, got a private ambulance service to drive him to Belarus. Belarus private ambulance service drove him to Russian private ambulance service drove him to Belarus, and then same again, the Belarusian private ambulance service drove him over to Poland, and Andrew and his wife were waiting for Victor, and he was evacuated in a Irish Air Force plane with a med team on board straight to Cork University Hospital. And poor Andrew.
Do you put yourself into the story, or are you behind the camera?
I come into the film at certain points, and first of all, I haven't mentioned before, the name of the film is Forsaken Frontier. If anybody wants to see it, you can see the trailers, they're already online. It's not finished yet, but the trailers are out, the teasers are out. It's there if people want to have take an interest in it. But yeah, I do become a part of the film at a couple of points. One for the delivering the letters, and another one is my own shelling incident where I described where I had to get my fixer and everything out of that incident, that close call.
Are there numerous people like you documenting this?
Well, I'm the only one on the ground with a camera specifically focused on the Irish angles, on the Irish stories. Yeah. I've been in country 5 months, and I've only met one other journalist that's Irish out there.
The difference is that it's the long game as opposed to news reportage. Yeah. So there is a difference, isn't
Absolutely.
There?
Absolutely. You're invested in your characters. It takes time. Yeah. You need access. You need trust. That's a big problem for me, actually. And I have to differentiate myself from the TV journalists, because there's a huge security issue around TV journalists filming something that goes live, and then the Russians look at it and go, I know that position.
Oh, yes.
Bam, 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 bam. Shells come in. Right. So I have to really work to get my access, to get that footage, to
reassure them that
my stuff comes out in 1 year's time. It will be no longer operationally relevant by that point. So it's a difficult game, and TV journalists make my job hard, I must say.
And you're funding this yourself. It's a labour of love.
Absolutely, a labour of love. I've been on it now a year. Sunday is a year since I've been on this project. But yeah, I'm motivated to finish it, because if I never finish it, I'll have the weight of that on my shoulders for the rest of my life. And I nearly died twice for it. So, I mean, I have to finish it. I have to push it over the line. And I just right now I'm knocking on a lot of producers' doors, trying to get funding to secure this next trip and get a distribution deal.
A huge, vague question. But like, what are your thoughts on war now?
War is hell, right? It's not a nice thing, and everybody's really quick, whether on social media or whatever platform, to threaten each other with violence. And you know, it's when you see it, it's it's horrific. But that's the thing about war. It brings out the very worst in humanity, but also the very best,
yeah,
you
but,
know?
But I'm just looking at the Oscars there and the BAFTAs and All Quiet on the Western Front, you know, has won left, right and centre, which, you know, is documents World War II. Wasn't it World War II or World War I?
First World War.
First World War, World War One. And I suppose when you watch that, you think, oh, well, you know, that'll never happen again. But here we are.
It's on our doorstep.
Young men going to war and being slaughtered.
It's on our doorstep, Ray. I mean, I was living in Berlin at the time the war broke out. It's a 10-hour drive to the Ukrainian border. And for the last 20 years, we've had war in the periphery of Europe, whether in Mali, Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, always on the periphery. Now it's creeping into our neighbourhood. And, you know, very quickly, we take it for granted. And I knew back then, 2014...
We take peace for granted. Yeah.
I mean, I knew back then, 2014, watching the Maidan Revolution, that the European long peace that we've enjoyed for 70 years is incredibly fragile. And we can very quickly fall into a perpetual downfall of a spiral of violence. And sure, look, there's people in the north of Ireland that want to bring us back there as well. You were talking just recently, before I came on, about the 25th anniversary and Joe Biden arriving. I mean, and there was the constable who was shot just a couple of weeks ago. You know, it can very quickly spiral out of control. And we just... there's one thing that really struck me when I was in Belfast. There was on the peace walls they have, there was never such a thing as a good war or a bad peace. And that it's the truth. But I mean, war brings out the best and the worst. And I'm trying to show the best of the Irish out there doing their job and showcasing the Irish humanitarian spirit, because nobody else is. And I'm the only one on the ground with a camera specifically focused on those Irish stories.
Yeah, but would you bring with it an understanding of the geopolitical history to it? You know, and a real, you know, passion, I suppose, for it. How refreshing to hear an honest, unbiased account of the Ukraine war. It's David versus Goliath struggle against a nation who have never lost a war. Alas, I think Ukraine cannot win this war. And these stories need to be told. A lot of misunderstanding about the war out there. I'm a teacher and will be showing Finn's film if possible. When is the release? You need funding, don't you?
That's the main goal. I'm in the trenches alone for 1 year now, and that's not just an expression.
Yeah. Okay. Can you ask your guest if he thinks this war will end ever or soon? We sort of covered that. It's a generational thing. And Putin. So, like, at the beginning, it was all about Putin, and this was, an act of a sort of a psychopath or whatever. And everyone thought that he would lose support within his own country, and that would be the end of the war. That doesn't seem to be playing out like they predicted.
No, he still enjoys maybe 70% support rate. And the initial narrative from the beginning is liberating Ukraine from a Nazi regime on the doorsteps of Russia. Now, there's nothing so unifying to the Russian populace as fighting the Nazis.
Yeah.
And where did that take place? In Ukraine 70 years ago. So the young lads that are being sent to the slaughterhouse now on the Russian side, they have the family pressure behind them, saying, you know, your granddad, all of his generation died fighting the Nazis, and you're only losing 10% of what we lost. Keep going.
Yeah.
So it's...
okay, so name the website as well, because people are genuinely interested, and you're interested in hearing from people who are interested.
Absolutely. So name of the documentary is Forsaken Frontier, and my company, production company, is Finhouse Films.
Right. Finn Boylan, thanks. We'll talk again.
Hopefully, right.
Mind yourself, and I mean that sincerely, mind yourself.
Cheers.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Text 51551. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Very interesting guy, Finn Boylan, there, and really looking forward to seeing his work when it's eventually finished. We were talking about Charlie Maxey earlier on, and we have Katie O'Donoghue coming into us after 4 o'clock. She has a beautiful little book called The Little Otter Who Tried. She's an art psychotherapist, and she's also a writer and an illustrator, and she's brought all her talents and skills and qualifications together to produce this lovely little book, The Little Otter Who Tried, and we're talking to Katie after 4 o'clock. Now, we read out an email at the top of the show about nail biting. I'll get to that in a moment. Anne in Douglas has been on. She says, it's good to keep talking about Ukraine. We can get complacent. and desensitised, and it's definitely down the list on the news agenda, isn't it? And that happens. That's human nature. And nail biting. Yeah. So our listener is getting married later on in the year, and is in her 40s, and she wants to do something about her nail biting habit. Just listen to that lady's letter about a bit nails. I too bite my nails as I was very nervous a little girl. Like her, tried everything until one day, I was 23, I was showing something to a group of ladies. I looked at my fingers, bleeding, skin picked away, and I just thought to myself, oh my God, if I had to look at that, I'd be physically sick. So I stopped there and then. That's 53 years ago. People admire my nails now. They're absolutely beautiful and so very strong. Good luck to that lady. It's all in the head, says that person. I think people realise that. And Maeve has been on. She says, long time nail biter myself, but getting fake nails, shellac, gel, etc. was the only thing that worked for me. P.S. Vinegar and lemon didn't work. I love the smell and taste of both. Oh, God. Mary in Salt Hill says, my 22-year-old son has been biting his nails for 10 years. Only recently I sent him a short clip I found on Instagram of a video with the title, What is Under Your Fingernails Under a Microscope? There were lots of wiggly little wormy bacteria having a field day, feeding away. He was cured as he is fastidious about his personal hygiene. I hope this helps. That often doesn't work for people. And I'm a 65-year-old man who has stopped nail biting since the 1st of January. It's never too late. Share with us how you did it. Was it just a New Year's resolution? Tell the lady to just keep her little fingernail for biting. Oh, the others will grow. And when she sees them grow, she'll be so delighted. But keep the little finger for biting. There's loads of different suggestions. I wonder, is there a sort of a CBT, cognitive behavioural therapy, or a psychological cure for it? And if anybody's encountered that, hypnosis, would that work? Anything that would help? 51551ray@rte.ie. Now, we put out the call at the top of the show. We're asking you if you have something to say about your St. Patrick's Day parade. Kevin Flannery is the chairperson of the Mount Collins Development Association, and he's on the line from Southwest Limerick, as in Mount Collins. How are you doing, Kevin?
Good afternoon, Ray. How are you doing?
I was just looking where you are. You're close to Cork.
We're close to Cork. We're close to every place in the middle of nowhere.
What's the population of Mount Collins?
About 270 to 300 people, I'd say.
Right. Okay. Right. So it's a small place.
Yeah, it's a small place. A small community. I suppose. Yeah, we're on the boundary of these and.
You're breaking up there. Come in, Mount Collins. Are you moving around there, Kevin? Or
can you hear me?
Yeah, wherever you are now, just stay put and keep your hand in the exact position that it's in and your head. So between 270 and 300, small village. You haven't had a parade since the year 2000.
Yeah, year 2000. We had them 5 or 6 years in a row before that, and then Foot and Mouth came and put a stop to a lot of things. And I suppose insurance costs on top of that then. Didn't help. So, yeah, the parade has gone with the last 20-odd years, and I suppose a few of us got together there, and I suppose we were talking nostalgically, and we said it'd be great to put the parade back together again, and we looked into it, and we found it viable, so we shot notice about 6 weeks ago, we got together and started putting the thing back on the road again.
Brilliant. The Mount Collins St. Patrick's Day Parade returns after a hiatus of 23 years. I remember that year, actually. Do you remember it, the Foot and Mouth? Because
I do, unfortunately.
Yeah, because the Dublin Parade was postponed till June.
Yes.
And it was a beautiful day. I thought it's probably something they should do every year. But anyway, so what are we talking about now? Is it it's floats and local businesses and all that?
I suppose a lot of local businesses have sponsored the parade and covering costs and things like that. But our parade was usually non-commercial, so you didn't have business. So it was really a fun parade.
Yeah.
Individuals or businesses put on fun floats, and we had bands, and we had the local football teams and soccer teams. They had their float out as well, so yeah, it was really a fun day for a family day.
Great, and it's up the main street of Mount Collins.
There's not too many main streets in Mount Collins. we won run and that's it.
That's it. Yeah. And you're, whatever money is made is for Milford Hospice, which is a lovely thing. So there'll be a lot of dressing up, and the local characters will be out, won't they? That's the thing.
We've plenty of those anyway.
Yeah, we'll have to get on to our colleagues, as they say in this organisation, in news, and make sure. suggest that they might cover the Mount Collins St Patrick's Day parade.
Well, they're more than welcome.
Yeah, they're
more than welcome.
Because they do that roundup on the 6 o'clock news, which is a lovely thing, I think, every year, isn't it?
Yes. It's very entertaining to watch. Yeah, all the different towns.
Who's your person down there? Who's your RTE correspondent? Is it Pascal Sheehy? Would he be covering you?
Yeah.
Pascal. We get on to Pascal.
Pascal, the man.
Well, listen. Good luck with it.
Thanks, Miller.
And we look forward to seeing you on 6-1 News. That's Kevin Flannery from Mount Collins. Now, we're just going down the road, actually, to Kanturk, which isn't too far away. And Tim McCarthy is there. How are you doing, Tim?
I'm good, Ray. And yourself?
Yeah. Well, what's it between Mount Collins and Kanturk?
We'd be about 25 minutes up the road.
That's all. Yeah. Now, you're not putting on a parade. You're going off to Europe to the Black Pudding Championships.
We are. We're heading over to Confier de Chevalier de Goutte-Boudon.
Oh, look at you. Look at you, Richard.
Just rolls off the tongue, doesn't it?
Say it fast and with confidence. Isn't that it, Tim?
Yeah, say it fast.
Come on, give it to us again there.
The Confier de Chevalier de Goutte-Boudon.
Are these the boys who walk around in robes and carry maces and chains of office and all that sort of thing, is it?
They're the very ones. They actually came over to bestow honours on us in 2010.
Yeah.
And we won the overall championship.
So there,
which was a great honour.
Yeah. We may have spoken to you or definitely mentioned you back then. So these are the world's sort of, I suppose, experts on black pudding. Well, that's that they've self-appointed.
Yeah, black pudding aficionados. Some of them are pharmacists, doctors, teachers, but they absolutely love black pudding, the same as ourselves. We've much in common.
I just, when I saw them, because they were up in Newport as well, weren't they? They didn't, Butchers in Newport win 1 year as well.
Yeah, they were above with a great colleague of ours, Sean Kelly, great operator.
That's great pudding. And do you know much about them, Tim? Like, how did it all start? Because it sounds and looks a bit cultish.
It does.
Yeah.
They're the experts on it. They put up an award, I presume it started within France.
Yeah.
When myself and Sean started sending over entries, I'd say back in the start, about 10 years ago, maybe 12 years ago, we were one of the first Irish entries.
Mm.
And we did very well in the first couple of years. And then in 2010, they decided they'd come over and promote it around here, which was
brilliant.
A great honour.
Yeah, to get anyone
out of France in recognition of Irish food.
It got huge coverage. So do you have to bring your star black pudding? Is that it, your signature one? Or do you bring a range of them?
There's many segments or categories over there,
yes.
And we send 4 entries this year.
Right, go on.
We send 2 traditional, which is pudding is traditional everywhere. Above a Mayo, Sean makes a very traditional pudding to that area. The Kerry pudding has cow's blood, we do it with pig's blood.
Right.
And it all has little intricacies everywhere. But we sent over two of our local entries, 2 of our traditional entries, and we sent 2 speciality entries.
Give us your best speciality there. We're running out of time.
We ran with chocolate and pistachio this year, and Teeling whiskey, Kanturk cream, and apple black pudding.
Wow. Apple and black pudding goes really well together.
Apple and black pudding, whiskey cream and apple.
Yeah. And then I'll have to try that chocolate and pistachio black pudding. That sounds interesting.
I can arrange to send it up to Dublin.
When are you heading off?
The competition is on Friday, Paddy's Day, so hopefully that's a good luck charm
yes.
for us. And then the awards are next week, which we hope to get over for once we find out how many gold we win. We're not going for one, we're going to win them all.
Aye, fight and talk. Bon chance, Tim.
Merci beaucoup.
Yeah, right. Good luck. See ya.
Thanks, Ray.
See
Thanks
ya now. Man. That's Tim McCarthy. McCarthy's of Kanturk, and they're flying the flag for Irish black pudding. Now, quick commercial break.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Alfie in Raheen has been on, and he says, you're probably not aware where Eclair is situated. Eclaire. But I'll rectify that right now. The beautiful Eclair is situated in the heart of the picturesque Ox Mountains in County Sligo. 6 miles from Tubbercurry, 6 miles from Clunacool, and 6 miles from Bonnyconlan, 4 miles from the beautiful Lough Talt. As a matter of interest, 14 miles from where President Joe Biden's ancestors came from, Ballina. Now, I will say without fear of contradiction that it's probably the best parade west of the Shannon. Music and song fills the air, top-class floats, depicting all walks of life going back in centuries. It starts at 4:40 p.m, that's an odd time, and the crack goes on until the small hours of the morning. Do call if you're in the locality, you'll be more than welcome. And on a final note, I have the honour of being the Grand Marshal. Such an honour. If the New York Parade Committee called me and asked me to be their Grand Marshal, I would say, sorry, I'm doing a Clare. That's Alfie in Raheen in Athenry. That's a lovely email. So we look to everybody taking part in the Clare parade. I love that. 6 miles from Tubbercurry, 6 miles from Clunacool, and 6 miles from Ballyconlan. Great, all great names. All great names. Anne in Kinsealy's been on. She says, Happy Pi Day, Ray. For those who use the month-day format, March 14th represents the value of pi, 314. Well, you see, that'd be the American way, wouldn't it be? As in 9/11, we would say 14.3. But anyway, International Day of Mathematics, or Pi Day, is celebrated on the 14th of March every year to recognise the mathematical constant pi, which defines the ratio of a circle's circumference to its diameter. The value for pi is 3.14. I first came across this when my daughter, who now lives in Vancouver, celebrated Pi Day with her friends by meeting up, and each person brought a pie. Yes, of course they would. It celebrates mathematical constant pi, often depicted as its approximate decimal 3.14. Pi Day was celebrated for the first time in 1988 by American physicist Larry Shaw. The value of pi was determined to a record-breaking 22 trillion decimal places in 2017. By a computer, I presume. Interestingly, legendary mathematician Albert Einstein's birthday anniversary falls on Pi Day, says Anna Kinsealy. Thanks for all the information, Anne.
Pi. 3.14159, this is pi, followed by 2653589, circumference over diameter 79, then 323, OMG, can't you see? 8462643, and now we're on a spree. 38 and 32, now we're blue, oh.
Yeah, there's a song, goes on. I remember having a chat with a maths teacher from Kildare called Jimmy Downs, used to play rugby with him, about pi in the back of a taxi at 3 o'clock in the morning. That's just brought back the memories there. And which reminds me, I have to go down to Kildare Rugby Club this week. They've asked me to give a motivational speech to the team. They're in the Towns Cup. I don't know what to say. I've no idea what to say. Imagine being in a dressing room and go, I played a bit of rugby. Good luck. I'll have to work on that. Anyway, the quiz. Yes, the whodunit quiz. Here we go. Two quizzes are standing by. Three questions each and a prize. It's a two-night stay for two people at Fota Island Resort in Cork. FotaIsland.ie. And it's nestled there at the heart of a peaceful island. Loads of things to do. Swimming pool, world-class spa, cove restaurant. There's a golf course. And then you have the Fota Wildlife Park, Fota House and Gardens. And you're a stone's throw from Cork City. You can go the other way to Ballymaloe, Ballycotton. Loads of things to do. FotaIsland.ie. Two-night stay for two people. Hello, Audrey.
Hi, Ray. How are you?
Good. You're in or on the Navan Road. You're not in the Navan Road.
I am indeed.
Yes. Yeah. In Dublin. What's going on in your life today?
Today is my birthday.
Yay! Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Audrey. Happy birthday to you. You don't want to say?
I will. I'm 61 today.
Right.
The big party was last year.
Oh, was it? Yeah. What do you do to celebrate your birthday today?
Today I went out for lunch with my parents and my sister, and tomorrow I'm going out with a good friend of mine for afternoon tea.
Lovely, lovely.
Yeah.
You're a big traveller, so you've been to where?
Where have I been? My favourite place has been Sri Lanka so far.
Right. Well,
I've been to South Africa, Australia, China, India and Egypt, and the next big one I want to do is Japan.
A lot of people say Japan is on their bucket list.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be so different from anything we know.
Yeah, and I'd love to see it in the cherry blossom season, which I think is the month of May.
We must dig out John Spillane's song. His lovely song about the cherry blossom, the dance of the cherry blossoms. When are you going? Are you actually going?
Hopefully next year.
Right.
I think.
Okay.
This year it's a cruise, so hopefully next year.
Right. Where are you cruising?
I'm cruising Italy, the Greek islands, Malta, and back to Italy.
All around the Mediterranean, lovely.
Yes, Eastern Mediterranean.
Yes, I believe you bite your nails too.
I do, yes. I put my hand up on that one. But after much perseverance, I think I have a full set, fully grown.
Right, and how did you achieve that?
I kept putting on the artificial nails on it.
Yeah.
And A, they're very expensive to keep doing and doing and doing. And eventually, I let them come right down to my own nails were going underneath it and they were well down. So when she took them off, there wasn't really... I didn't really need to fill them in as much.
Yes.
So this time round, it would be complete, just ordinary paint.
And from your experience, is it initially it's maybe nerves and then it becomes habit. Is that it?
I don't know. My mother said I started doing it as a child. And then I think when you get unoccupied with your hands, you do kind of find they're in your mouth before you realise it.
Yeah, habit. Okay, but it seems in your 62nd year that you've sorted it. Good, great.
I hope so.
Yeah, you're up against Helen McCarthy, who's in County Meath. How are you doing, Helen?
Hi, Bray. How's it going?
Not too bad. You're Helen to Wexford to see your sister.
I'm nearly there now.
Right.
She's the mobile home down there and it's opened up for the season.
Ah,
so
lovely.
Just
so this is the first?
Yeah.
The first of the new season?
This is the first of the new season, yeah.
And will you get into the sea?
That's the plan. We have the togs. So
yeah.
See what the weather's like.
not to put you off, but they say that March is the coldest month.
Okay. Well, it's very sunny down here now.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. No, the water is not as cold as, but if it's warm, if the air is warm, that helps because you go in and then you come out and that's fine. Yeah. Look, this is mad, but you bite your nails as well.
I do, and like you're. The lady that I'm in contact with, I did the false nails as well, and I've taken them off now, and they're actually in a very bad state. So I think I'll be putting the false nails back on again.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
So, there's more people than you think. Obviously, if there's the lady that sent us the email, now there's 2E. Like there must be an awful lot of people out there. I think we'll have to do a bit of work on this and maybe get somebody in who's an expert on it. What do you think? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
So,
definitely.
How close to Wexford are you?
I'm nearly there. She's on Rosslare Strand, so I'm probably about another 10 to 15 minutes before I'll be there.
Nice. I was listening to Claire Byrne when they were broadcasting from Rosslare, and she was saying that there's Tai Chi on the beach. I don't know which day of the week it is. Yeah.
Okay.
Would you be interested in that? That might be a nice thing to do.
I would, I would. Yeah,
I should
look into that.
You should look it up, yeah. I think she said it was free. Tai Chi, free Tai Chi. Okay, right. It's Audrey versus Helen. Three questions each. I tell you the category and then I ask you, do you want a clue? If you go for a clue and get it right, you get a point. If you go without a clue or clueless, as somebody suggested, and you get it right, you get 2 points. Whoever has the most points at the end is the winner. And if it's a draw, we go to a tiebreak question. Good luck to you both. Here we go.
Good luck, Audrey.
Okay, Audrey, music. What do you want to do?
Without a clue.
Without a clue. Okay, for two, who is this? Well,
I haven't a clue. I want to guess Blue.
Blue. No, a boy band. You were in the right area. Take That is the answer.
Oh.
That's Up All Night from 2008. I would have found that difficult myself. It was just, they went off my radar, I suppose. Don't fret yet. Helen.
Sorry.
Music for you as well. What do you want to do?
No clue, Ray.
No clue. Okay, for two, who is this? Who's that?
I don't know.
No. REM, Shiny Happy People. Right, so it's an even start. No points on the board.
Okay.
Right, so we're starting afresh. So Audrey, second category is TV characters. TV characters. So
No clue.
No clue, okay. And remember, we're looking for the character's name as opposed to the actor's name. So which TV character is this?
I am someone who is looking for love. Real love. Ridiculous, inconvenient, consuming, can't live without each other love. And I don't think that love is here.
Who's that?
Bridget Jones.
No!
Ah!
Carrie Bradshaw. Sex and the City. Played by Sarah Jessica Parker. Right. Again, in the right ballpark or there, but, you know, famous, iconic female characters. Helen, chance for you to go in front. TV characters. Do you want a clue or not?
No clue.
Okay. Remember, character, not actor. For two, which TV character is this?
Finally, just when I'd given up hope, I cluttered into an aerial thing and fell 50 foot to the ground. It was only by the grace of God that I landed on something soft. No, it was not my head. I landed on a very unfortunate and very unsuspecting courting couple. Due to your vicious mind and general walliness, they have had to put their wedding back 6 months.
Well...
Okay, is it Del Boy from Only Fools and Horses?
It is Del Boy, yes. You okay. Get 2 points there, yeah. Played by David Jason. Your general walliness, a great phrase. Okay, Helen, you're on two. Audrey.
Okay.
Yet to score. You need to go without a clue this time. The category is Irish Outdoors to be able to chance. So if you go okay. for this, no clue, get it right, you're on two as well. And if Helen falters on the final question, then we're into a tiebreak situation. So still, yeah. You're not out of it yet. So Irish Outdoors, you have to say it to me, you don't want a clue. Yeah, you don't want a clue?
No clue.
Okay. So people from the outdoors, people who are known from the Irish Outdoors. For 2 points, to keep you in the quiz, who is this?
Botanic gardens were originally set up for the study of plants, and in those days, hundreds of years ago, it was mainly for the study of plants of economic importance, food crops and so on. Nowadays, they are still, of course, for the study of plants, but they also have a teaching function for gardeners and horticulturalists, and also for the public to come and enjoy.
Who's that?
Jerry Fleming.
Oh! I thought you were going to get it there. The Jerry, okay, but not Fleming. Jerry Daly, oh. Yes. Jerry Daly and his herbaceous borders, yeah. Okay, not to worry. We're going to send you out a Ray D'Arcy Show Keep Cup.
Brilliant.
Yeah, and I'm going to put together, I'm sure we've some books up there, just a little hamper of books for your birthday.
Great. Thank you very much.
So happy birthday.
Good,
enjoy the rest
well
of your day
done,
and the celebrations tomorrow. Thanks, Audrey.
Thank you.
Well done. Bye, 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 bye.
Thanks. See you. Bye.
Bye. Helen. Congratulations, you are off to Fota Island in Cork.
Brilliant, thank you so much.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
I don't know if you've been there before, so much to do.
You have the
wildlife park, the house and gardens, you have the spa and the swimming pool. Oh, fantastic. FotaIsland.ie.
Absolutely.
Okay,
yeah.
Drive safely and enjoy your little spell down Rosslare. Thanks, Helen. Bye now.
Take care, thank you. Bye.
The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Email ray@rte.ie. The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, I'm joined in the studio by Katie O'Donoghue, author of The Little Otter Who Tried. Good afternoon, Katie.
Hi there, Ray. Thanks for having me.
Now, in this book, you've drawn on all your skills and qualifications. Haven't you? Yeah, yeah.
I suppose I have. Yeah.
So give us your list of qualifications first.
Okay, so I have a master's in art psychotherapy, a degree in fine art and design, and I'm near the end of a PhD in health psychology.
Right.
So.
Okay.
Yeah.
And art psychotherapy is a protected sort of label, if you like.
It is in the UK.
Right.
And that's what our accrediting body in Ireland is trying to work towards as well, as we sort of seen on the news recently.
Yes.
How important it is for people to know if they are going for psychological supports, that whoever they're seeing is accredited in whichever membership.
Okay. So before we talk about the book, then let's talk a little bit about art psychotherapy. So it's using art to treat people.
It is, yeah. So, I mean, it's been formally recognised, I suppose, since the 1960s. Any art psychotherapist in Ireland has has a master's level degree, and they would be accredited by the Irish Association of Creative Arts Therapists. And how it, I suppose, fundamentally works, it is a psychological profession, and we support the client to express themselves using art, different forms of media, whether it's painting, drawing, clay work, to sort of look at and explore those difficult emotions, thoughts and experiences. And it can be particularly useful, say, for some experiences that might be, maybe we actually don't even have the words for. Not that they're too hard to verbalise, but we don't have the words for them
yet. Okay, and is it for children and adults?
Children and adults, yes.
Because I remember when we were at college, we were asked to draw a picture of our family, for example. Okay. And seemingly you can tell an awful lot by how a family is portrayed in a picture.
You can in some ways.
In some ways, right.
But the important thing is what the, whether it's the child or the individual, what they're telling you about the picture itself. So it's a process between client and therapist.
Okay. So so is it sort of like a triangulation? So
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Is that it? Right.
Yeah.
So you get them to draw a picture and then you talk about the picture, but through that chat you find out more
and
about
it. And it can be, so it's usually non-directive, so that it's client-led and they might want to chat or they might be very quiet in their art making process. And that's all part and parcel of sort of attending to where the client is in that moment in time.
And what's the brief? Like, what do you ask them to do?
It can depend. So say when you first meet a client, whether it's a child or an adult, they may be coming for certain difficulties or challenges.
Yeah, it could be grieving, for example. It could be loss,
For example. And sometimes, maybe for an adult particularly, you know, if you get landed with a piece of white piece paper in front of you, that's a bit like, oh no, I can't do that, due to drawing on your own childhood experiences. But we'd sort of ask them maybe to explore the art room, pick up the different materials. Some people find that they can't go near the white sheet of paper, but they might look at collage or, and they just sort of get into a flow. It's what we're first trying to do, is get the person comfortable really and build up that therapeutic relationship, just like in any other sort of form of psychotherapy.
Yeah, but I suppose it's less daunting, less threatening than a one-on-one looking into somebody's eyes. And that's why they probably feel a little more. Is that it?
It can be. It can be. In a way, I mean, you're still at times maybe choosing to have the eye contact or not. But you are sort of...
So here's the question, I suppose, that I should have asked at the start. Why would somebody choose art psychotherapy over normal psychotherapy?
I suppose there's no right or wrong, is what I would say. We're all individual, and sometimes we might be attracted to try one form of something rather than something else. I think it's very open. And what I say to anybody who's going for therapy or wants to see a therapist, ring around, maybe try different forms of, you know, whether it's music therapy or counselling. And I think as well, it can be mostly to do with the connection between the client and the therapist too. So if you feel that you can trust that person, I think that's the first step in the right direction.
Yeah, it's terrible to have to shop around, but that's Now, the little otter who tried, it's a lovely little story, and it was inspired by a wildlife programme that you saw on the telly.
I think so, is what I was telling Emily earlier. I think I was one. I do like watching sort of the nature programs as well, and I enjoy getting out and about in nature anyway. But I just remember being quite surprised by, I don't know why I thought it, but you know, otters, they're so graceful, the way they swim, and I just thought it was something that occurred naturally from the minute they were born, that they could swim along with their mothers, but they can't. Their head is dunked under the water, and they get pulled along, and they learn through mom and her support and having breaks. So I thought it was the perfect little animal to kind of represent not just kind of the journeys and the challenges, but also kind of the connection and support that you can have from your caregiver and your parent as well. So
And you say the sort of at the beginning, there have been many inspiring women who have supported me throughout my life and believed in me when I found it hard to believe myself.
Mm-hmm.
This book is dedicated to everyone who has been a special adult in a child's life and has empowered a child to believe that they can do anything. And that's the mammy otter is one of those women, if that's what you call a mammy otter. And the little otter, as well as his mother, he encounters all sorts of wildlife along the way, from a frog to a kingfisher to a little duckling, and they all have different types of advice.
Yeah. So what I try to draw in the book is sort of the different pillars of resilience, and for, you know, each encounter has sort of a different message. So, you know, for example, one of the things that's quite challenging for children nowadays through social media in general as well is that comparison. So children gain their sort of sense of self through being able to compare themselves in contrast to their peers. And it could, unfortunately can have sort of negative impacts as well. So, for example, with the little duckling, the otter cannot believe how quickly they can swim and it looks so effortless. But actually, the duckling explains, well, if you look under the water, I'm paddling really hard. And you can see that. So it's kind of giving the message to children that someone might feel that, oh, that person seems to have it all together, or they're great at everything. Whereas actually, we never really know how hard somebody's trying underneath it, yes, all, or what's, yes, going on for, yeah, them.
And somebody else, maybe it was the duckling, encourages little otter to concentrate on what they can do well. Because, yeah, we all have different skills.
Exactly.
Yeah, and different talents. Yeah. Yeah. I believe you're giving a talk, a webinar on resilience. Yeah. I'm fascinated by resilience, particularly, yeah, with young children, because, mm-hmm, I think there's an awful lot of talk about mental health and the pressures that young people are under. And I think the way to sort of counteract that, to prevent that, is to develop coping mechanisms early, yeah, in life.
Exactly. And I suppose that webinar is in collaboration with the ISPCC and Childline. And that is a free webinar for any parent who wants to join. And that will be on the 28th of March if they want to look at the ISPCC's website. But yeah, there are so many challenges for children nowadays. And one of the things that can sort of buffer and help children against that is to give them those, you know, coping skills early in life. But as well as I kind of mentioned too, that, you know, resilience, yes, it is the term, it's thrown around, yes, quite a lot. But if we understand what it really means,
okay,
it's,
go on,
it's not just our inner resources.
You
it's our, you know, it's our connection with it for children, with our caregiver, the parent, that close connection. It's the peer support. It's that sense of the wider community and that sense of connection and belonging. And when you have all three of them together, that's what really promotes resilience for children. So it's
a secure base.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, core base, I would say.
Core base. No, so you can't, well, if that's the case, then you can't teach resilience then, can you?
Well, you can start.
Right.
But it's a combination. And I think a lot, you know, building up on those coping mechanisms so that a child has inner resources when, for example, mom or dad aren't there at school, or if they don't have that person to go to, they can look at their own frame of reference. Okay, what did I do last time? How did I try and solve this challenge, yeah, or approach it? And then when they go home, have that chat and get, okay, that support.
It's a bit like the little otter.
Exactly.
The little otter tried. It's a lovely little book, beautifully illustrated.
Thank you.
With lovely watercolours. Are they watercolours?
Yeah,
they are watercolours.
Yeah.
And there's themes going through it which will help you to talk your young child through the challenges that life is going to present. Katie O'Donoghue, thank you so much. Lovely
thank
talking
you so
to
much,
you. Thank
Ray.
You. And The Little Otter Who Tried is available in bookshops now. That's it from us. Cormac is on Drive Time today, it being Tuesday. We are back tomorrow at 3 o'clock. Enjoy the rest of your Tuesday evening.
It's the Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.